Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of The Negotiation. And on today's show, I talk with Marlene Sharp, an entertainment executive known for her role in globalizing Japanese game franchises like Sonic the Hedgehog. Throughout her career with Level 5 Abby and Sega of America, Marlene tackled the unique challenges of adapting Japanese franchises for global audiences. Now leading Pink Poodle Productions, she utilizes her extensive experience to provide specialized services for IP franchises that span the Asian and North American entertainment markets. During the discussion, Marlene addresses the evolving landscape of international entertainment, emphasizing the rising influence of Japanese, Korean, and Chinese franchises in the West. Enjoy.
Surprisingly, there has never been a hit animated show themed around K-pop. There have been some attempts. BTS had a show on Crunchyroll last year that didn't quite go the way people expected, given the BTS army and so forth. But this show that I'm working on, K-pop Odd Couple, is, I'm hoping, going to be the one to like really break through and help Korean animation to reach the heights of Squid Game and Parasite.
Home to over 4 billion people, the Asia-Pacific region boasts one of the most powerful consumer markets on the planet. Not only is it home to half of the world's under 30 population, but it's also home to more than half the world's internet users. It's a market that no globally minded organization should ignore. But entering markets like China, Japan, or Southeast Asia is no easy task. Just ask the likes of Microsoft, Google, Uber, and Facebook. However, times are changing, and with the right partners, doors are slowly opening as more and more companies find success growing their key markets in APAC. I myself spent 8 years in China, mostly as a venture capitalist, helping early-stage tech companies grow in the Asia-Pacific market successfully. This show is dedicated to uncovering and examining successful Asia market entry and growth strategies by interviewing the experts who've done it before and truly understand what it takes to be successful in the region. My name is Todd Embley, and welcome to The Negotiation. Brought to you by WPIC Marketing and Technologies.
Marlene, welcome to the Negotiation Podcast.
Thank you, Todd. I'm excited to be here.
Okay, so where in the world are you sitting today that we're recording you from?
I am sitting at the headquarters of Pink Poodle Productions in Los Angeles, California. And Pink Poodle Productions is my company, so.
Yeah, and we're going to get into that. Yeah. Awesome. Well, thank you. Taking your time out of your day to speak with us today. Tell us a little bit about, and I always love to ask this, how in the world do you end up based in California to be involved with Asia? What is the backstory that led to all of this?
The short answer is temping. Temping was my entree into all things Asia. It was not part of my original plan. So the original dream was to be an Oscar-winning actress and or Tina Fey by this point in my life. And that's not exactly what happened. But when I was a baby actor new in Hollywood, I started temping because that was an opportunity to earn some consistent-ish money. And within a couple of weeks of temping, I landed at the consultancy of the former president of Bandai America, whose his name is Frank Ward. And I was a temp to perm assistant. For those people in your audience, maybe who aren't familiar with Bandai, it's the toy company behind Power Rangers. And Digimon and Tamagotchi and a whole lot of other huge Japanese toy-driven brands. And so Frank had retired from Bandai, but had started this consultancy to work on all the IPs that had TV shows and movies attached to them. And then I came on board as his temp and then his assistant and then director of development and then I've never really left that business. I've been in the merch-driven, Asian-oriented, meaning the foundations are in Asia, content business.
Now, you've had significant roles at Level 5 Abby, Sega of America, managing properties like Yo-Kai Watch, Sonic Boom. What drew you to work specifically with these Japanese franchises?
In the case of Sega and Sonic the Hedgehog, my intro to, well, of course, I knew Sonic from the games, but I was actually working for a Jordanian company for 5.5 years, and we were pursuing Sonic the Hedgehog as a potential license. At that company, RGH Entertainment, we were looking to either license or co-produce iconic properties that maybe could use a refresh or a rebrand. And so we had partnered with MGM on Pink Panther and with DreamWorks Classics on Postman Pat. So Sonic was one of the IPs we were pursuing. So in that research process and getting to the bottom of the rights and things like that, I found out that Sonic was in the middle of a resurgence. So Sonic Boom was already in development at that point. And it turned out that the relationship with RGH, the Jordanian company, didn't work out. But I think that put me in the ether of things going on with Sonic and Sega. And within a couple of years, I was contacted by a recruiter from Sega on LinkedIn. So LinkedIn, shout out to my go-to social media platform. And so I don't know if it was coincidence or maybe a little bit of kismet and coincidence colliding. And also I'm a maniac on LinkedIn. But yeah, I've always loved Sonic, but there were like two or three different forces that brought me into Sonic's world. And then once you're in the Japanese IP business, Japanese IPs and people in Los Angeles working on localizing and marketing that type of content, it's a small world. And there's a group of us. We know each other, and not to say that it's a closed group. There's always people coming and going, but I guess word gets around and you run into people. And but actually the level 5 job is something else that manifested from LinkedIn. Yeah. Shout out to LinkedIn.
Yeah. Shout out to Reid Hoffman. you know, thank you very much, buddy. Let's focus in a little bit on that. And it's not like we want to get negative, but I want to ask you about challenges. Okay. So what do you find to be some unique challenges that you face while adapting these types of brands for global and obviously particularly Asian markets?
If working on a big well-known IP like Power Rangers or Sonic the Hedgehog, especially, those brands have been around for a long time and they have an existing fan base, but yet in order to attract new people to the IP, it's necessary to have somewhat of a refresh. Also, to attract new stakeholders, new licensees, merchandise licensees, and so forth. So it's always a balance of pleasing the existing fan base versus doing new and exciting things to attract new people into and new licensees into the fan base. But also, I do not speak Japanese or Korean or pretty much any. I'm really good at English, though. I am English. Give me something in English and I can nail it. But not Korean or any other language except high school and college French. And even that is a little iffy. But so it would be easier for me to navigate certain parts of the business if I spoke Japanese, certainly in localization, because there's a lot of translating and then reverse translating and copy editing and so forth. And so, yes, that would definitely make things easier. And it would, quite frankly, make things easier if I came from Asia. I am not from Asia. I'm from the Deep South. I'm from New Orleans. So nothing in my background prepared me at all for this part of the entertainment business that I'm pursuing, but I did study acting. So I guess I'm good at faking it, I guess, is the conclusion here.
Fake it until you make it. I want to elaborate, or maybe ask you to elaborate, on cultural considerations, because there are certain sectors of markets where this is far more important, absolutely necessary in some segments, that you really have to keep in mind and redefine some aspects of a product or its cultural presence or the understanding that people might have of it. When it comes to game-based franchises, what are the cultural considerations that you had to keep in mind when you're introducing them to different international audiences, especially in that area of the world?
I would say the cultural considerations are more internal in the business, the inner workings of the business, and also approvals, like the approval process, because in dealing with Japanese localization, there is a huge amount of respect that goes toward the content creators. So, for example, when I was working at Level 5, Hino-san is the king of Level 5. He started the company. He creates everything that comes out of Level 5 is from Hino-san's brain. And then he does work with collaborators here and there, especially on the music-driven or musical properties, one of which, for an example, is Snack World, which I worked on. And so there was a lot of music, and we had to translate lyrics into English, and then there's extra adaptation that goes with matching lyrics to notes and accompaniment and things like that. And so then we had to get things approved by the creators. So that's something different than what would happen with IP from another country. Like, whoever is the rights holder of the music usually has the approval to, you know, say, yes, you know, you can go ahead and record this and what have you. But the rights, I guess, are kind of bifurcated in the sense that the creator has rights, as well as the owner of the IP, meaning Hino-san and Level 5. So we had to get extra late. We had to build into our approval process, in our schedule, and then in our budget, extra layers of approval for the creators to say, no, this is not an accurate interpretation of what I intended. And so it's just a matter of realizing that from the beginning, building it into your budget and schedule, and not being surprised when it happens, when it takes longer than what you might be accustomed to doing with IP from another country. But any of the decisions that I've been involved with to adapt content, whether it's from Japan or Korea or Jordan or Italy or India, any other place, it's not been to squash the cultural complexities of the area where the content's coming from. It's always been a decision to make it more inclusive for the rest of the world, and also to sell products. Everything that I've ever worked on has been designed as merchandise driven. So it's driving consumer behavior to sell video games or to sell toys and or apparel or themed experiences or whatnot. And so nobody is looking to just insert changes into the IP just for arbitrary reasons. It's always because, okay, we need this to satisfy the toy company that has the master toy license, or we need this to, you know, appeal to these different territories where we've sold the TV show or something like that.
Now, I want to open this up to Pink Poodle Productions. So why don't we start with the elevator pitch? Tell us what is Pink Poodle Productions first off, and then we'll get into more.
Pink Poodle Productions is me and my dog, Blanche Dubois Sharp, who is the mascot, muse, chief inspiration officer of Pink Poodle Productions. So right now you are lucky to be getting the sum total of the Pink Poodle Productions personnel roster. Although Blanche is taking a bit of a break at the moment, but she might make herself known. But yes, that is the sum total of Pink Poodle Productions. But we do have a lot of collaborators.
And what are the primary services you offer? And maybe on top of that, how do they tie into your past experiences with the Asian entertainment makers?
Yes. So we offer a variety of services. We consider ourselves a consultancy, and any of our services, well, we're negotiable. So like if someone needs a combination of different things, even if they might seem to not necessarily go together, whether it's advising on a product launch, whether that product is content or toy or apparel. Like for instance, one of our clients is an apparel brand, and we've been guiding them on acquiring licenses for various high profile IPs. So I would say a lot of them are based in Asia. Some of them are American or come from other places, but this particular IP apparel company wants to have licenses that they of IPs that would go well with a streetwear brand. So they have a high end streetwear, and then they also create content to support that online content. So we're an advisor for that company, but then we also develop TV shows, we develop movies, we do a lot of marketing for events, film festivals, and also nonprofits. I work very closely with the autism community in a variety of ways. There are a number of autism nonprofits that I've worked with on marketing and PR, but also education. It all started with me advising a school that trains adults on the spectrum for careers in animation. So I have worked a lot in animation throughout my career. And that just opened up a lot of doors. And now I'm working with a number of nonprofits. So it's a little bit of this and that. It's hard to explain it in a short, concise way. I'm not a short, concise person, unfortunately. But I'm trying, Todd. I'm trying for the sake of the podcast to be brief.
You're doing a very good job. Now, you have worked extensively with both Japanese and Korean partners. I guess my first question is really to juxtapose the two cultures when it comes to doing business and creative collaboration. How do they differ?
Well, they differ historically and geographically. Those are the obvious differences, but there is a lot of common ground. And I've found that through the years, seems to be more and more collaboration. There's more and more common ground than there are differences, to the point where Japanese companies, animation studios are really busy, really in demand right now for their skill, their the beauty of what they execute for their market, but also people in other forms of entertainment want that anime influence or the look or the authenticity that working with Japanese creators or companies can bring. And so so as a result, Japanese animation studios are booked years in advance, especially if you want to hire them for like a contract type of job, as opposed to, well, they create their own content, but also there was a time when they were, Japan was a go-to studio for work-for-hire animation. Well, now Japan needs to hire other countries, studios from other countries to fulfill all the orders that they've gotten for animation, animated projects through the years. So Japan has started, or it's not started, this has been going on for a few years, but Japan loves to hire Korean studios because Korean studios are very adaptable at anime style. And they're fans. Japan and Korea are fans of each other's content. Japan seems to love K-dramas and K-pop, to the point where K-pop is sort of more popular in Japan than J-pop. So there's a lot of interest in each other's creative process and output. So it's really an exciting time for joint ventures between the two companies, between the two countries, rather.
Now, given your extensive background and experience in the world of entertainment, if we zoom out a little bit, I want to ask you how you think or how you've seen the landscape of international entertainment change, maybe over the last 20, 25 years, particularly in terms of Asian content's influence now on the West instead of vice versa.
Oh, yeah. Well, it seems to be way cooler now to work with Asian content than it was when I first got into the business decades ago. And that's so great because you don't need, you meaning me, I don't need to explain to people from the beginning of a conversation like, okay, I'm the LA office of this company that's in Korea and they would like to do business in, you know, there used to be, the elevator pitch was quite long and now it's shorter, thank goodness, because people seem to have less time anyway. And so there's more of a familiarity because of the huge success of so many IPs. And the successes are not considered one-offs anymore. It's just to be expected. And something new in anime is on the horizon. The expectations are high for it to perform well, and people anticipate it. So thank you, Squid Game, and thank you to, you know, every Transformers and Sonic the Hedgehog and things like that for paving the way for other IPs to come forth and be able to break out. And then also the success of the music industries from both countries. So it's easier to pitch things now, but still not a slam dunk. It's not really a slam dunk with any bringing anything new to the market these days in my experience, although I'm not Steven Spielberg. So I'm sure when he goes into a meeting, he can light up the room with whatever it is he's got in his briefcase. But it is a challenging time in Hollywood. So it's not like you can walk in the door with an anime-based IP and just expect people to throw money at you. It's still work, but it is better.
I would also say even, and correct me if I'm wrong, because I'm shooting from the hip here, but Sega, Nintendo, they just even going back to gaming consoles from the late 80s and early 90s, stemming from that area of the world where everything was digital, and then cartoons, and then there's cult into the comic book. You know, and we've seen the rise of the Avengers things, and that was all, you know, a lot of Stan Lee and DC Comics and things. But this is all Pixar, right? Really bringing animation to the forefront of, hey, this isn't just, you know, cartoons aren't just for kids. And it was this evolution now. And then you've got, you know, Jim Carrey in Sonic the Hedgehog movies and things. And so would you agree that this kind of timeline of gaming and whatnot, that is like the geeks are taking over, right? What used to be super geeky is now very mainstream. And that's just due in large part to what is influenced from Asia.
Yes, I agree. 100%. Yes. Yes, most definitely. And sometimes the public doesn't even realize where the source material comes from, especially like the younger generations. They might gravitate towards something from what they've seen online or word of mouth or older siblings or things like that. And they don't even realize where the influence is or where the underlying creativity
origination
comes from. Yeah, yeah, where it originates. But yes, geek culture is... it's not geeky anymore. It's mainstream. And all you need to do is go to a Comic-Con to see that. Yeah. It's so crowded. People are fighting to get in, and there's not enough badges to satisfy all the people who want to go.
Yeah. I mean, Comic-Con can almost rival CES at this point. So
yes, most definitely.
So if you're listening and you're young and you're looking into becoming a game designer, maybe as an elective, study Japanese.
Yes, yes, I would say so. Yeah, language study is so important.
It is, and I mean, going back to what we were talking about a little bit earlier, the impact of language on culture, or the ability to understand culture through language. I think for 75% of people that I have ever known that really understood Asian culture well, they would point to learning the language and then letting the language help them understand the culture. And we've mentioned translation quite a bit, but the better word in a lot of instances is interpretation. Because if you translate, if you took a narrative or a monologue or a commencement speech out of an area of the world from there, and you just translated it, it would likely make very little sense to you. Very colloquial. And riddled with references to ancient writings. It's very poetic. Where North America, we're just kind of very literal and we use a sledgehammer for everything. It would behoove you. And that's where a lot of it can come from. Would you agree with any of those sentiments I just put forth?
Oh, certainly. Certainly. Yes. Interpretation is very, very important. And authenticity too, because if you change things too much, you alienate people. You either alienate the people who were fans from the beginning, or people who just value the origin of the source and are respectful of culture, and then they can go online and get other people riled up about it, and then that can destroy your effort to bring something to new audiences. But yes, interpretation is so important. Localization, reversioning, it's not like an easy translation process. There's massaging that needs to go on every step of the way.
It's really localizing.
Localizing, yes.
Given your expertise, what advice would you give to brands or content creators, whoever might be interested to successfully enter and go cross-cultural and break through those boundaries, especially in entertainment?
I think keeping a dialogue going with the fan base is very important. And everything that I've learned about fan whispering, or all the valuable stuff, came from my former Sega colleague, Aaron Weber. I never get tired of singing his praises because he is a genius. First of all, he is a fan. He started working at Sega when he was 14 years old. And at the age of 30, he was in our office with like the longest track record of anybody at Sega. And he was one of the youngest people in the office. So he started as a fan, and I sat next to him for a year, and always riveted by what was on his screen, because he was in the trenches communicating with people, responding to, what might have appeared as a petty complaint by somebody, just somebody disgruntled with whatever, saying Sega is trying to kill Sonic for this reason or that reason, which was never the case. But Aaron was such a brilliant bridge between the fan base and corporate. And I really enjoyed just observing what he did on a day-to-day basis. So I think the more that you can involve the fans and pay respect to them as consumers, but more than consumers, they have a parasocial relationship with your character or whatever it is that you've created. So yeah, I would say, pay attention and embrace the opportunity to make them feel heard and respected.
Can I ask you a question about fan base management, and maybe just broadly, is there a difference in between the East and the West in their approach or philosophy around fan base management?
I think so. Yes, I've not been in the trenches of fan base management from the Asian side. Like, I've always been doing it in an LA office, or, you know, with from the American perspective. I've never
in
done
English.
It.
Yeah.
Yeah. In English. Right. But from what I can see, from what I've observed, there does seem to be more of a mindfulness at this moment in time from the American side of the fan base. Whereas in Japan and Korea is more like corporate rules based. Like, so there's this corporate policy in place. And if something, if something violates this rule or this law, then, you know, the person must be stopped on YouTube, for example, or like, you know, you're doing this wrong. There's a rule about that. Follow this rule. But I think really in terms of Sega, Aaron was very, he was not afraid to take on Sonic Team in Japan and put himself, you know, lie on the hill of battle and offer himself up as a sacrifice for the sake of the fans. And he was the reason why Sonic Mania was made. And that was a game that was developed and crafted by fan developers. So fans are going to put stuff out there, and they're going to make fan art and fan games and fan fiction.
NFTs.
Yeah, the NFT, they're going to do it no matter what. You can try to shut it down as if you're the owner of that IP, but actually the foundation of Sega, the way it was a Japanese entity and an American entity that came together and formed Sega as we know it. And it was copyright infringement, basically, on the part of a Japanese coin-operated company. And then the gentleman who owned the American company, instead of saying, oh, I'm going to shut this down, he said, let's work together. And then the two came together, and now it's known as a Japanese company. But the origins of Sega are very, it's interesting how that spirit of embracing differences and like putting conflict to rest and, you know, celebrating everybody's input is part of the Sega history. But I think when it comes to Japan or Korea, or even, I've worked with Indian companies and or Jordanian company and so forth. And there might be a little bit more of a barrier of, you know, diving into the fan base directly.
Are there some new projects or markets within Asia that you are particularly excited about and are going to be exploring further?
Oh, yes. Well, first, this is a great opportunity for me to show you the shirt that I'm wearing. Banania. I don't know if you're...
Wait a minute. Is that it looks like for those listening, she is wearing a shirt where it looks like there is a large cat who is overfed coming out of a banana that is half peeled and open.
Yes. Banania, the cat who lives in a banana. So actually, Banania is not new, but Banania is a big hit and only getting bigger. And so, Banania is a property of TMS Entertainment, which is celebrating its 60th birthday this year. It's one of the oldest animation studios in Japan, and it is owned by Sega. And my friends and colleagues gave me this shirt, and I love it. I love Banania. I've loved Banania for years. And so, so this is really just an opportunity to say happy birthday, TMS, and congrats, Banania. Banania's got a new season of her show coming out on Netflix.
Well,
I believe it's next month.
Banania Mania.
Yes, yes. There's an article in Animation Magazine about Banania. So anyway, Banania is only the sky's the limit for Banana. And another shameless plug disguised as a crystal ball moment is an animated series that I'm working on that debuts on EBS in Korea next year, so next spring or summer, and it's called Mongli Syndrome K-pop Odd Couple. And surprisingly, there has never been a hit animated show themed around K-pop. There have been some attempts. BTS had a show on Crunchyroll last year that didn't quite go the way people expected, given the BTS empire, BTS army, and so forth. But this show that I'm working on, K-pop Odd Couple, is, I'm hoping, going to be the one to like really break through and help Korean animation to reach the heights of Squid Game and Parasite. So Korean animation has not really had the ta-da moment that the live action IPs have had. And so I'm hopeful. It's a really awesome, the music is awesome. So every original song, every episode, and it's very girly and pink and cute and adorable and all the things that I love in a wonderful piece of content. So I'm proud to be associated with it. And I would like to predict great things for that particular show.
Marlene Sharp of Pink Poodle Productions, thank you very much for coming on the show today. We really appreciate your time.
My pleasure, Todd. This has been great. Thank you.
So for everybody who is watching us on the YouTube video, if you need your eyes and your hands for other things, feel free to go over and listen to the podcast on all your favorite podcast platforms. And if you're listening to the podcast, you want to catch some shorts and some other information, please feel free to head over to the WPIC website and click on the links to get to the YouTube channel where this video will live. But from myself and from Marlene and from everybody at the negotiation team, thank you very much for listening and or watching. And we will see you next time.
Growing a company is hard. Doing it in a foreign market, exponentially so. The best piece of advice I can give you is not to do it alone. When you start looking at the Asia-Pacific region for further expansion possibilities, and I sincerely hope you do, make sure you choose the right partners to do it with. My good friends at WPIC Marketing and Technologies have almost 20 years of experience helping brands, just like yours, enter China, Japan, and Southeast Asia. I hope you enjoyed this episode of The Negotiation, and if you're interested in being a guest or want to connect with me or any of our team, please reach out to us at podcast@wpic.co, and be sure to rate, comment, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.